Was 2020 the year Americans finally lost faith in their institutions?
There is this widespread feeling in the United States of being distrustful of government, of feeling like, you know, that they're not going to be there for us. And I think Americans felt that most acutely and powerfully during 2020, and the book documents the extent to which our kind of chaotic leadership from the White House down really imperiled the lives of Americans and fostered the spirit of division and distrust, which are long-term legacies of that year. But unfortunately, we haven't done nearly as much as we could to sustain gains or to rebuild trust in the years after. I think that's part of why things feel so fraught and explosive today as we head into the summer of 2024, you know, fearing what's ahead.
That's Eric Kleinenberg. We talk with him about his acclaimed new book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. It follows seven New Yorkers as they try to cope with a pandemic. Among them, a transit worker, a bar owner, a retired lawyer who organizes a mutual aid network, and a Black Lives Matter protester. Their stories and those of the others illustrate how our leaders and institutions failed them and us, and how some citizens stepped into the breach. Then, in February 2021, we spoke with journalist John Nichols about why President Biden's bold plan for COVID relief was defeated by the Republicans, joined by a few centrist Dems. We listen back to that conversation. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. 2020 was a momentous year in our nation's history. The worst pandemic in a century was raging. The country saw the largest protest movement ever, with people of all races uniting in support of Black Lives Matter. The economy plummeted, and the government spent trillions trying to keep people afloat. It was also the year that many Americans lost the last shred of faith they had in our institutions. Yet, you hardly hear anybody talking about what happened that year anymore. That's why Eric Kleinenberg's book, 2020, is so important. He follows seven New Yorkers whose experiences illuminate how Americans reckoned with 2020. The book vividly captures these stories, casting them against the backdrop of a high-stakes presidential election, a surge of misinformation, rising distrust, and raging protests. Kleinenberg's book 2020 not only helps us reckon with what we lived through, but also with the challenges we face before the next crisis arrives. Eric Kleinenberg, welcome back to Writer's Voice after a long time.
Yeah, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
This book, 2020, you talk about it not only in terms of the year itself, 2020, but also 2020 vision looking backward. COVID is still with us. We're only 2 years from the last serious wave with the Omicron variant. Over 1.1 million Americans have died, yet nobody talks about it anymore. And just the other day, somebody told me COVID is over. You say we need our day of reckoning. What do you mean by that?
Well, something incredibly powerful happened to us. I mean, we experienced a series of traumas in 2020 that inevitably shaped us. And, you know, of course, COVID and the pandemic is a big part of that, but it's not the only thing. And the book 2020 is also about, you know, the economic crisis where millions of people lost their jobs and the markets crashed, and people felt a kind of economic security that they hadn't in generations. And the book is also about the murder of George Floyd and this fact of police violence and structural racism shaping American life in ways that we sometimes avoid grappling with. The book is about the abandonment of cities. It's about the spike in violence that happened in the United States, almost uniquely in the world, at a time when most countries were able to kind of come together and achieve some level of solidarity to get through the threats. And the book is also about the attack on democracy and democratic institutions in the US. All those things happened just a couple of years ago. And I think we need a reckoning because we are suffering today from a kind of long COVID, not the medical condition, but long COVID as a kind of social disease. The distrust and the division and this dispirited nature of American collective life all got more intense and more durable during that year. And I think we see long COVID as a social problem show up in all kinds of things in our world today in 2024. I think that it's shaping our politics. I think it's going to shape our election. It shapes our culture wars. It's shaping life on college campuses this year. And so I wrote the book as an invitation for us to face up to it and to talk about what we live through and to reckon. Because if we don't, it's not like the thing isn't there. It's just acting out on us like something we've repressed, but is deep inside of our bodies and minds.
And why do you think we have repressed it so intensely? I mean, this is not the first time that, well, not just Americans, but that people have forgotten an epidemic almost as soon as it has died down. I mean, I think the same thing happened in 1918, but it's really bizarre and eerie to see it happen so quickly. We lost so many people. Why do you think people are practicing this kind of amnesia?
Well, you're right. It's a repeated pattern. In fact, one of the best books about the 1918 flu influenza pandemic is called America's Forgotten Pandemic. And there is a tendency to want to move on. And I think we could think about this in a couple different levels. First of all, at a human level, it was a little overwhelming to be alive in 2020 and absorbing everything and grappling with everything. I mean, for a lot of us, it was scary to have COVID in the world. A lot of people felt like they were suddenly vulnerable in new ways. They didn't know if they would survive. They didn't know if their parents would survive. They didn't know what would happen to their kids. They didn't know what happened to their jobs. A lot of people got sick and had to deal with the repercussions of that. A lot of people did lose loved ones and close friends. As you said, more than 1 million Americans died. So often when that happens to us, our impulse is to, try to put the bad feelings in a black box and kind of soldier on and get through it and move to the next thing. And I do think that at some psychological level, it was just too much for a lot of individuals to bear, the pressure of the moment. And it's a hugely unpleasant experience, if not downright scary, for a lot of people. And so I just think psychologically, one of our defense mechanisms was to put it out of sight. We have this will not to know. But then I also think that 2020 and COVID in particular, as political events, are really tricky. As we know, on the right, there was a strong effort to downplay the significance of the disease, in some cases to deny that it was anything more than the flu. We were urged to move on and to stop whining about it by many. And so I think for many on the political right, COVID stands today as this kind of manufactured crisis. They insist that it was exaggerated, that we overreacted, and so they want to push us to move on. And then I think, for Democrats, COVID also represents a kind of problem because, in some ways, President Biden overpromised for what he could deliver. He promised that the pandemic would end. It didn't end right away. He was more optimistic than you probably should have been, that the vaccines would just make the thing go away. And so it's hard for the Democrats to run on their success managing the health crisis after 2021, because although 2020 was far more chaotic and dysregulated and disorderly, and I think ultimately 2020 did much more damage, and our political leaders did much more damage in 2020. The failure to just get rid of the COVID crisis and get things back to normal haunts the Democratic Party today. And so they're not, for the most part, all that interested in running on it either. And I think for those reasons, this is a long answer, but I think that's part of why we're just more comfortable pushing it away than looking at it closely.
Yeah, I think that's really an important point. You know, we remember the role that Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema played in basically tanking, making sure that, you know, because no Republicans would vote to extend the COVID pandemic measures, that really, despite all of their problems and disparities in application, really helped a lot of Americans to keep their heads above water economically, to stay above poverty. And those were all taken away. And I think that was an incredible political blunder. I don't fault Biden for that. I definitely fault the two Democrats and the entire GOP. But I think that just emphasizes the whole way in which our political establishment does not have the trust of the American people, could have had the trust of the American people, but gave it away.
The book is, you know, is organized around the stories of seven really different people from different walks of life with different political views. One person from every borough of New York City, you know, plus a Black Lives Matter activist, and the story of a subway worker who died very early in the crisis, an immigrant from India. And I think what unites the stories is the through line of each person feeling abandoned by core institutions at a time of need, of being left, you know, on their own to solve whatever personal problems and collective problems we faced. And, you know, eventually in the US, much later than other places, but eventually we developed this system for, you know, making people more secure. There were stimulus payments, there were payments to keep some businesses afloat. The most dramatic and important policy that we used to improve people's lives during the pandemic was the Child Poverty Reduction Act, which reduced child poverty in the U.S. by record numbers, lifting more than 5 million kids out of poverty at this time of great peril. And then what happened within a year or so is that all of those measures, which were meant to create a safety net, were pulled out from under American voters. And you're right to say that, you know, the reason is that Manchin and Sinema and the entire Republican Party are responsible for our failure to extend those measures and for our failure to build out more with these really ambitious infrastructure and climate and jobs proposal that the Biden administration worked tirelessly to push through. But in the real politics, you know, I think most American voters don't care who specifically is responsible. They see it as a collective failure of Congress and government, and they see it as a specific failure of leadership in the White House. And so there is this widespread feeling in the United States of being distrustful of government, of feeling like, you know, that they're not going to be there for us. And I think Americans felt that most acutely and powerfully during 2020, and the book documents the extent to which our kind of chaotic leadership from the White House down really imperiled the lives of Americans and fostered the spirit of division and distrust, which are long-term legacies of that year. But unfortunately, we haven't done nearly as much as we could to sustain gains or to rebuild trust in the years after. I think that's part of why things feel so fraught and explosive today as we head into the summer of 2024, you know, fearing what's ahead.
Yeah, terrifying. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eric Kleinenberg about his latest book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Yeah, so these seven New Yorkers, you tell different pieces of the story through them. And so let's start with the disparities in healthcare resources in hospitals and nursing homes, by the way. Tell us about Sophia Zayas. She worked for Governor Cuomo, and we should note, despite him, you know, being a so-called pandemic hero or touting himself as one, he made some really devastating decisions in the beginning. So tell us about her first, and then talk about Cuomo's initial response, as well as the response of Bill de Blasio.
Well, so Sophia Zayas is, you know, one of the seven characters. She's a, you know, wonderful person who was the Bronx regional representative for Governor Cuomo's office in 2020. And her job involved making sure that institutions in the Bronx had the resources they needed to continue their work and to support people. And those institutions included the hospitals, which, you know, of course, in the early weeks of the pandemic were completely overwhelmed. They didn't have PPE. They didn't have ventilators. They didn't have bays to store all the dead bodies from people in the Bronx who were dying. And Sophia's job was to work overtime 7 days a week to get everything she possibly could for her community. And, you know, the chapter about Sophia is called 24 hours a day. And that's basically what her work responsibilities felt like. She's from the Bronx. She lives in a housing complex in the heart of the Bronx, and it's a, you know, working class neighborhood. She had several neighbors die, including her next door neighbor and very close friend. Her grandfather lived across the street, and he survived COVID, but had a number of people, I think seven in his building, die early in the early days. She could hear the sirens all the time. I mean, she was totally inundated in this world. And, you know, through her, one gets the sense of just what it felt like, I think, to be at the heart of this crisis. And New York City was really the epicenter of the world. It was the hottest spot on Earth for quite some time. And the Bronx was one of the deadliest places you could be in New York. And the, you know, the difficulty for Sophia also, I should note, is that, you know, she was scared for her own life and for the life of her family. And also, like many Americans, and especially like a lot of Black and Latino Americans, somewhat skeptical of the medical establishment. And so, you know, one really salient part of Sophia's story is that when the vaccines finally came out, a big part of her job was trying to get the vaccine distributed in the Bronx. And Cuomo, in one of his better moments, prioritized getting the vaccine available to residents of the Bronx because it was so hard hit by the pandemic, and because he was concerned about inequalities, meaning that, you know, poor neighborhoods and Black neighborhoods would have less access to the vaccine. So he prioritized distribution of the vaccine. But Sophia herself is afraid of the vaccine and skeptical that maybe it's being tested on, you know, Black and poor communities, because more affluent and powerful communities are, you know, want to see what happens first. So she is charged with this responsibility of distributing a vaccine that she doesn't trust. And the personal drama that she lives with and the stress of managing that situation, I think, is, it really speaks to underlying concerns that, you know, are a big part of the American story. When we don't trust our scientists, and we don't trust our government health agencies, and we don't trust each other, we become really dysfunctional on multiple levels. And Sophia's story speaks to that.
You know, I mean, all the stories here were heart-wrenching for different reasons, but one that really affected me was the story of Daniel Presti, because it seemed to me that this was a case of a guy who, you know, was just an ordinary American, not particularly political, who became seriously radicalized toward the extreme right as a result of the lack of respect and trust that his government showed towards him. It's really a fascinating tale. So talk about Presti and how his journey to radicalization happened.
Well, it's a very powerful part of the book for me because, you know, I first learned about Presti the way most people did, if they followed his story, which is, you know, he was in the news. I saw someone post about him on Twitter in the midst of this massive far-right demonstration on the streets of Staten Island, which is the most conservative borough of New York City. And Presti was a big spokesperson. And when I first saw images of him and saw the rally, I felt really disgusted by the situation, like that, to have the Proud Boys and the far right demonstrating against public health measures in New York. It just seemed really odious to me. But part of being a social scientist and a writer is to suspend your own gut reactions to things and your judgment and to try to do research and learn more. And I decided to dig into his story and reached out to him and was able to do some long interviews with him. And his story is actually remarkable. And again, it speaks to something much larger that happened in the US. He's from Staten Island, which, as I said, is a pretty conservative borough, comparatively speaking. And he always saw himself as apolitical, just didn't care that much about the public conversation on politics. And when 2019 started, he and a pal of his from the neighborhood were starting this idea of opening a new bar. They wanted to have like a community bar, like a public house in the neighborhood that, was not a place where you had Fox News on, like a place where you'd go after your softball game or your long day at work or to have an office party, just like a neighborhood establishment that would be good for social life. And they applied for a liquor license, which everyone who opens a bar has to do, and were dismayed that it took months and months, almost a full year, for them to get a response from the state. And they couldn't understand, like, there's this liquor authority and their job is just to issue liquor licenses and to make sure the system works. Like, why did they need so much time to help them get their business up and running? And when they reached out to the government to ask why, you know, they were turned away pretty summarily and rudely, you know, like, we'll get back to you when we get back to you, as if they didn't matter. So they, you know, were not doing things to make money on the side. They were kind of waiting, and that was financially difficult. But the bar finally opened at the end of 2019. And unfortunately, the timing was bad because soon after, the COVID arrived and everything got shut down. And, you know, in New York, initially, you might remember, the boroughs that were hit hard were Queens and the Bronx and Brooklyn, parts of Manhattan. But Staten Island, you know, being an island, was a little bit more protected and the COVID rates were pretty low, but there was no, you know, geographic based shutdown system. The whole city just got shut down. And you asked before about Cuomo and de Blasio. And, you know, one of the stories I tell to make it clear that the failures of America were not just in the White House, although the White House was the most influential, but like in New York, Cuomo and de Blasio were getting in these ridiculous bickering matches over who had the authority to close what and when things should close. And it was just this chaotic process of, everyone feeling confused about what was going on. But at the end of the day, it was a kind of blanket closures. And Danny said, you know, look, I'm not a political guy. And I recognize that, we got a pandemic and people could die. So they closed down the bar. And what was frustrating is that there were never any really clear guidelines for them about when they could reopen and how they could reopen. And they kept going back and forth. Like, they would open for a little while and then get closed down and serve food for a while, because that was the only way they could make money, was to do food deliveries, and then change that. It was chaos, and they were really struggling to make money. And at some point, you know, Presti and his partner tried to reach out to the mayor to the governor to get some kind of conversation going about when they could reasonably expect to keep their business open during the heart of 2020. And they felt like nobody cared about their concerns. And unlike in other countries, in the US, support for small businesses was a little bit hard to get. And there were some businesses that were quite capable of applying for federal support and staying open. But, you know, brand new businesses, and especially bars, really had a hard time figuring out how much money they could get and when they would get it. And these guys were not getting enough. So they got angry and they started to get political. And Presti started listening to talk radio and to Fox News. And he found the complaints about the callousness of the government to be persuasive. He felt like, you know, people in blue states were not adequately considering what it felt like to really need income to take care of your family. And they didn't recognize that not everybody could work remotely, and that a lot of the people were falling through the cracks, and they felt unheard. And at some point during a closure of all businesses that did retail and serve food in November of 2020, during another big COVID wave, Presti decided he'd had enough, and he reached out to a right-wing agitator, and they decided to declare their bar what they called an autonomous zone. And they put up posters, they got duct tape and marked off this area, that they had just declared that the laws of New York would no longer be relevant to them. And of course, you know, they didn't get to make that choice. And so the sheriff showed up and started to issue tickets and summonses. But then that's the moment where I entered the story. That's when the far right decided to convene on Staten Island to support the small business and do these really spirited protests that were, you know, not just about this particular bar or closure, but kind of against public health measures more generally. And Presti, over the course of the year, then gets swept away into this, so that, you know, by the end of 2020, this guy who's been apolitical his whole life, who wants to run a bar, is now, you know, calling himself a freedom fighter and protesting mask mandates and, you know, protesting vaccine mandates over in time, dumping garbage on the mayor's home in New York. I mean, really putting himself out there as what we now see as a far-right activist. And I just thought his story was so fascinating because it helps us understand this important thing that happened in the United States that, you know, we have to reckon with too. And that is that enormous numbers of people came to distrust the expertise of government and found themselves radicalized, including on the right. So his story is not there because I agree with his take on the situation. I don't. We have different politics, and I think a lot of what his activism has done is quite damaging. But I don't say any of that really in the book. I just tell his story so that you can see how something like that could happen to so many Americans during this fateful and confusing time.
Yeah, it was so striking to me. I mean, just one little example of the imperious capriciousness of the authorities. You know, the same state liquor authorities who drag their feet on giving him a license crack down on bar owners who put their tables outside while restaurants were putting their tables outside all over the place. But you're not supposed to serve liquor out on the street for some reason. In any event, they cracked down on them. He got arrested.
I mean, he got arrested also for, you know, keeping his bar open when it had to be closed. So, you know, he wasn't innocent in the story, I'd say. But you're making a really good point that I should have said too. Not only did the liquor authority send these people out, but they hired extra people when the pandemic started to more closely monitor, you know, which bars were staying open and which bars were closed, and, you know, to issue tickets and summonses to restaurant and bar owners who violated the rules. And, you know, from a public health perspective, that makes perfect sense. You know, you've got this lethal disease spreading quickly, and we're at the epicenter of it here. But if you think about the fact that the liquor authorities, you know, took its sweet time to issue the license to allow him to open his business in the first place, and didn't seem to care that much about the fact that the timeliness mattered to him, but then suddenly invested tons of resources in making sure that people close their businesses, that felt a little bit like a betrayal. So that he was asking, why, what is this government for after all? What is this authority for? And it sure feels like it's about punishing the little guy. And again, I think we could see things differently. I spoke to other bar owners who had a different take on the whole situation and operated in very different ways. I don't think his response was inevitable, but I tell the story so you can see the world from his perspective. And I know that, most people who read a book like mine might go into this feeling skeptical about, someone with Presti's political position. And I think it's important for everyone to reckon with why that became so compelling. Those views became so compelling to so many people during this time.
Absolutely. And I was one of those people who went into it skeptically as starting the chapter and ended up just, completely at a different level of understanding. And you mentioned the distrust of experts. Now, this was also something that really struck me during the epidemic. I mean, the WHO and the CDC in the beginning insisted, for example, that masks were useless. Now, a little background on me, I was for many, many years an occupational health and safety educator, and I used to teach people how to put on masks and do fit tests. And I'm very, very well aware that masks are actually a very effective way to deal with infection control as well as with other toxins. So I was shocked, not just at the CDC and the WHO, but also at Fauci. And even when I saw Lori Garrett, the famed health journalist who I had so admired for so many years, repeat the obvious lie that masks were useless. The real reason was because they were afraid there wouldn't be enough for health workers in the beginning, which is cognitive it just potentiates the lie. They say they're useless, but they actually are doing this because they are so needed by healthcare workers. So talk about the impact of that flagrant dishonesty.
If you spoke to someone from the WHO or spoke to Fauci, what they would probably tell you is that it wasn't that they said they were useless. It was that they didn't have specific evidence that this particular new coronavirus would be blocked by masks. And they wanted to wait until the science was in that really established that, this particular coronavirus would be less likely to be transmitted if you were wearing a mask. And of course, there was no specific research on this before 2020 because the virus didn't exist. So it was like an impossibly high standard to have to meet to make a health policy recommendation. And there are big questions about why they did that. You named one of them, one of the answers, which is they were concerned about a global run on masks and concerned that there wouldn't be enough for, essential workers and healthcare workers. And of course, in the US, we didn't have them for essential workers and healthcare workers in many places either, because we really failed to produce them like they did in other countries. There's also some debate about the extent to which China was trying to influence WHO's policies and trying to underplay the severity of the crisis so that it didn't rebound on China to stigmatize it and to make it an economic pariah. And there was a lot of concern about, whether the WHO was doing China's bidding with this policy. But the world kind of picked up on it. And the standards that we adopted here in the U.S. and many places seem really odd in retrospect. One of the things I write about in the book is the extent to which countries that were affected by the SARS pandemic or SARS epidemic in 2003 and 2004 really learned this lesson that masks can be extremely effective in reducing the transmission of coronaviruses. And so places like Australia and New Zealand and South Korea and Taiwan and Japan and Singapore, even Canada, they were much better than the US at mass producing masks, at subsidizing production and distribution, and taking a bunch of other preventive measures that meant, people were using masks even before we had specific scientific research papers showing that, in fact, masks, when used correctly and when you use the right masks, were very effective. And Unfortunately, it took, several months for the U.S. to do that. But I would say that the kind of failure of the U.S. to adopt mask requirements was part of a broader series of blunders that really do belong with the White House and the Trump administration, right? Like, refusing to accept the reality of this crisis was one of the most important mistakes in the Trump administration's response. Like, that if you look at his key statements from the beginning of the pandemic, as I did, you see all of this magical thinking of, like, it's going to be gone by Easter. I like the cases where they are, so I'm not going to let Americans who've got COVID, into medical facilities on shore. If they're on a cruise ship, that recommendations to inject Clorox and things like that. I mean, just wild, crazy thinking that were totally confusing to the average American at a time when we most needed information. And look, political leaders always have outsized influence in our conversations and our cultural life, but when you're in a moment of crisis and there's a new threat and you don't know what to do to stay safe or protect your family, that's when the official proclamations of presidents and health agency leaders have their greatest impact. It's when we really turn to our most influential, powerful people for advice. And the fact that instead of strong, coherent public health messaging and policies, we got dysfunctional, dysregulated, dishonest rhetoric from the White House was incredibly damaging to the United States. And not just damaging to our health, but also damaging to the health of our body politic, because it just made us so much more divided and distrustful of each other. And we still live with that legacy.
That's true. I mean, I wouldn't give Fauci a pass because he should have known better. But absolutely, I agree that Trump was, really pushing things into the most disastrous direction. And you are listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Eric Kleinenberg about his new book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. After the break, we continue our conversation, turning to some of the more positive forces to emerge during 2020, the growth of mutual aid networks and the Black Lives Matter movement.
Hey, did you see? Half the school has COVID.
So I guess we're just sending them to school?
That's what it says.
So I guess that's what we're doing. Da,
da, da, we don't talk about COVID. No, no, no. We don't talk about COVID. But we were wrong.
Should we really move along?
Now we have zero clue what's next.
What comes after Omicron?
Where can you even find a test?
In a warehouse in Florida.
And so I guess we think it's best.
It's the elephant in the room.
That we don't talk about COVID. No, no, no. We don't talk about COVID.
That was a song, We Don't Talk About COVID, a parody of We Don't Talk About Bruno by Holderness Family Music. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, back to our conversation with Eric Kleinenberg about his book, 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. I want to turn to another, I think, very important theme in this book, and that is that in the wake of, in the face of this massive failure of the authorities to protect the public health, people, ordinary neighborhoods stepped up to develop incredibly important initiatives of mutual aid. I was part of one. I was part of a group of people who sew in my community, and we sewed 1,500 masks for essential workers when it was really difficult to get them. And we used materials that were actually N95 type of materials that we were able to insert in there. So they were highly effective. But tell us about Nuala O'Doherty and the COVID Care Neighbor Network.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up this theme, because for me, it's one of the most important ones and one of the most hopeful ones in the book. Nuala is how I pronounce her name, is a spark plug. She is Irish American from a family of immigrants. She was the only one born in the US. She's married to an Ecuadorian auto technician. They have lived in Queens for decades. She went to law school at St. John's. They met in a bodega in Astoria. They live in Jackson Heights, Queens, which is one of the most amazing diverse neighborhoods on earth. There's something like 160 languages spoken in Jackson Heights. It's a very densely populated working class immigrant community. A lot of crowded apartments, a lot of people who are part of the cash economy, informal labor sector. And when COVID started, Nuala, who'd worked as a district attorney for 30 years, had just retired, and she was, you know, starting a campaign for a very local political office. And she realized that, you know, her community was going to be in crisis, that the virus was going to spread, that there are lots of people who are going to have to work and they're part of the essential workforce, and they'd go out and expose themselves to the disease. And she also knew that there were lots of people in Jackson Heights living in crowded apartments who would be transmitting the disease to the people they shared a home with. And anticipating that, and also anticipating the economic crisis from people losing their jobs, she decided to put out this poster, which she did. She hand wrote a note and had her kids Xerox it and posted around the neighborhood. And it said, you know, if you need help, call me. And she put on her mobile phone number. And within a couple of days, hundreds of people were calling her asking for help. And she was a little overwhelmed. So she then came up with another idea, which is to put out a poster saying, if you can offer help, call me. And she put down the same number. And again, hundreds of people called because they wanted to do something. And so within a week or so, Nuala and her neighbors had started this thing they called the COVID Care Neighborhood Network. And it's one of countless examples of mutual aid networks that Americans started, and really people around the world started during 2020, to support each other, to provide essential resources and support at a time when, you know, government was acting too slowly. And in Nuala's case, that meant procuring food and diapers and cleaning supplies and, you know, arranging for people to come and pick them up. And then when the volunteer base built up enough, getting people to go around and hand deliver them to folks who weren't comfortable going out of their apartment. And then some people had service needs, which her network began to provide. And you just see this neighborhood band together and bond together to do something really beautiful that I think is also in keeping with this tradition of American voluntarism. So we talk a lot about the hyper-individualism that made America such a dangerous and deadly place. But there's this other tradition of America, which is about participation and civic engagement. And over the course of the, you know, multi-year pandemic, the COVID Care Neighborhood Network did all kinds of things to make local life easier for people in Jackson Heights. They provided all tens of thousands of meals, all kinds of care services. They helped people get healthcare. They helped people get registered to get the vaccine. They started a campaign to create an open street that, you know, basically to turn a big boulevard in Jackson Heights into a park, an open street, like it closed to traffic because they didn't have access to green space and they needed a public place. And by the way, I reached out to Nuala recently to find out how she's doing. And it turns out that the same basement that was the staging ground for the COVID Care Neighborhood Network during COVID is now the headquarters for the Jackson Heights Immigration Center. And she and the same set of people are helping asylum seekers file their paperwork several days a week. And thousands of families have gone through them to get essentially pro bono legal assistance. So in some ways it suggests that one kind of the brighter legacies of 2020 is that there is today this kind of invisible civic infrastructure that's all over American communities that's helping us get through the challenges of the moment. And as many difficulties as we have today, it's important to recognize that we haven't just separated and become distrustful. We've also built at the local level some incredibly powerful organizational resources for rebuilding and coming together again.
That's wonderful. So another part of social solidarity that really struck me was the huge scaling up of the Black Lives Matter movement that arose in the wake of the death of and the murder of George Floyd. The first time, I mean, the largest demonstrations in U.S. history, the first time that white people joined en masse to defend the lives of Black people, I felt that there was a connection, you know, not just that more people had time on their hands, but that this expressed a kind of a solidarity that was bubbling up from below. I wonder if you could talk about, you do have a chapter on race that I think is very important, and this is an important part of it.
Yeah, and there's also a chapter about Brandon English. You know, he's, in fact, his photo's on the cover of the book. And for Brandon, this the year was about the Black Lives Matter protests above all. I think Americans during the early parts of 2020, they witnessed this pandemic playing havoc in our society, but they also recognized that some people were far more exposed, far more likely to get sick and far more likely to die than others. They felt betrayed by this language of the essential worker, which basically meant that you were expendable and put people in harm's way because we didn't protect people whose labor we depended on. We didn't honor them. We didn't recognize them. We didn't thank them. We didn't compensate them. We asked them to die for us, and they were disproportionately Black and Latino. And I think this growing sensibility about that inequality really fueled the Black Lives Matter protests and the explosion of interest in civil rights in the summer of 2020. And that, again, is like one of the extraordinary moments from that year that where we did see solidarity and cross-racial alliances. And, you know, I think what we didn't anticipate at the time was the extent to which there would be a backlash against that. In subsequent years, you know, from, you know, people on the far right, but also people in the mainstream right, including, you know, President Trump at the time, who really lashed out with those strong anti-protest policing measures that bring in the military and the riot police. But then we also saw it kind of enter into popular culture with people like Ron DeSantis, banning, Black studies from Florida's AP curriculum and cracking down on DEI and the organized campaign to ban books about diversity and equity and inclusion from libraries. So the backlash has been formidable. And look, I mean, here we are 4 years later, and we find ourselves entrenched in culture wars in a way that I think few of us could anticipate in 2020. And those things are at the heart of our politics this year.
And it's also why your book is so important for people to read. 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. Eric Kleiningberg, I just think this should be required reading for all Americans. It's a beautifully written book, fascinating. It really gives the big picture that we need to have as we go forward. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Eric Kleiningberg is an American sociologist and a scholar of urban studies, culture, and media. He teaches social science at NYU and is director of the Institute for Public Knowledge. During our conversation with Eric Kleiningberg, we spoke about how congressional Republicans were joined by two Democrats, Senators Sinema and Manchin, to end programs like the expanded child tax credit that had helped lift millions out of poverty. That was in 2022. Before that, in 2021, the same Congress members pushed to slash COVID relief spending proposed by President Biden. Here's an interview I did in February 2021 with Nation magazine correspondent John Nichols about how that happened. Go bold and go bold now. That's what the American people are telling President Biden and the Congress when it comes to COVID-19 relief. $2,000 relief checks, 74% favor them. Raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, 58% favor that. But GOP senators are either dead set against COVID relief or have offered a paltry package, less than one-third that proposed by Biden. And some centrist Democrats might be enabling them. So what should Biden do? For advice, we turn to political correspondent John Nichols. His February 3rd post in The Nation is titled, "Cutting $2,000 payments and limiting who's eligible for them is bad economics and loser politics." Well, John Nichols, welcome back to Writer's Voice. You start out with this piece, I just have to quote it because your language is just great. The same cabal of compulsive neoliberals and centrist grifters who derailed meaningful progress in previous Democratic administrations are at it again. So tell us who they are.
Well, they're not just Republicans. That's an important thing to understand. There are Democrats and Republicans who buy into a theory that you can never really solve problems, that at the end of the day, all you can do is maintain the status quo and maybe ease the pain, but not go to the heart of the matter. And the way this works is that when the United States gets itself into a very, very difficult position, be it with a stock market collapse or a meltdown in the housing market, or in this case, a pandemic and the economic downturn that extends from it, it's very clear what you should do. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt did in the Great Depression. You spend your way out of the crisis. It's smart, right? But there are people who will always tell you that you can't do that, that you've got to keep the books balanced, that you have to avoid spending at the level that is necessary. And at the end of the day, what happens is that too frequently, Democrats accept these arguments coming from mostly Republicans, but also some Democrats, and they end up constraining their governance in a way that ultimately causes people to resent them. And that's what I mean by loser politics.
You call on the GOP side, you say, well, of course, they're the probably the majority of GOP senators who will never vote for anything that Biden would put forward. But then
that's
there's
right.
The obstruction caucus who have presented a bill that is less than a third of what Biden has suggested. What do you feel is their motivation? Are they really trying to tinker around the edges and solve problems?
It's a very good question. And I think their motivation is twofold. First and foremost, I think that some of them do sincerely believe in a sort of austerity approach. And it's rooted in a very elitist, very privileged way of thinking as regards the role of government. And their sense is that government exists to make sure that wealthy people have the resources that they need to manage the economy. And what they basically play that out through what Reagan and others refer to as trickle-down economics, right? The idea that you would make the rich really rich, and then some of that would trickle down to the rest of us. And that's clearly a big touchstone for a lot of Republicans. And they're wrong, but not necessarily fully evil in that, right? So that's one component. But then there's an evil side as well. And this is not to be underestimated. And that is, frankly, that I don't think there's any question that there are many Republicans who want Democratic presidents to fail. They may, you know, talk a good line at a press conference or something like that. But the truth is brought out by the record of, you know, what happened after Barack Obama became president. And you had a meeting with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and others, and their strategy that they developed on the night that Obama became president was, you know, how do we undermine him? How do we obstruct him sufficiently so that this very popular new president doesn't succeed? And I don't for a second believe that these folks have changed in their mentality. And so I am quite sure that there are many of these Republicans who are, quote unquote, negotiating with Biden, who are doing so with an eye toward assuring that he isn't that successful as a president.
What is the remedy? What can Democrats do? I mean, they have two ways open to them. There's budget reconciliation and there's ending the filibuster. So let's take the first one first. Talk about
sure.
Budget reconciliation and, you know, what can it do and what can't it do?
Budget reconciliation can do some very big things, but it can't do everything. And the way to understand budget reconciliation is that it's an old law, better part of 50 years old, and it was essentially passed to get around presidents messing with things. But one of the key elements of it is it said that on certain budgetary items, in order for the House and Senate to move quickly and effectively on major issues and to put their imprint on those issues, they can develop essentially a fast track. And that fast track allows them to identify something that is clearly budgetary, clearly financial, and say, this is essentially an emergency. So if the House and Senate can agree on what they're doing, they can move it through without having to get super majorities or, frankly, jump through a lot of the traditional hoops. Shorthand, it allows you to go around the filibuster. So that's effective. That means that, for instance, Budget Committee Chair Bernie Sanders could develop out a measure in cooperation with the Biden administration, perhaps through this $1.9 trillion relief package, and they could get it through with 50 Democratic votes and Kamala Harris breaking the tie. All the Republican obstruction is tossed aside. So that's a very effective thing. The problem with budget reconciliation is you can only do that on a narrow set of budgetary issues. And you are always sort of walking the tightrope on whether you're within the parameters of it. And so it's not really a replacement for filibuster reform. You still need to get rid of the filibuster as it's currently abused and either eliminate it altogether or, to my preferred model, move toward the traditional idea of the filibuster, which is the talking filibuster. And that is that if someone, for a principled reason, wants to oppose a bill, or even a group of senators want to oppose a bill, you know, if they're willing to get up and talk for 24 or 36 hours on the floor of the Senate, that's great. I don't have a problem with that because they may touch the hearts or the minds of the American people and cause a shift in the political process. So I'm willing to accept that kind of filibuster, but that's not what we have now. What we have now is simply a bureaucratic tool that a minority party can use to prevent action, not just for 24 or 36 hours, but for days, weeks, months, even years. And so, to my mind, they really do need to do filibuster reform, and I favor that as the ultimate solution to the problem.
And that kind of filibuster, does that mean that they would talk for, you know, an extended period of time, but then it would still go to a vote and a majority could win without the two-thirds majority needed?
Without the 60-vote majority. Yeah, exactly. The talking filibuster, the historic concept of the talking filibuster was that an individual senator could get up and object and talk until they collapse. You know, it's Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith goes to Washington. That's the concept, right? And remember the theory of Jimmy Stewart was that, you know, he got up and gave that speech. People listened to it on the radio, the Boy Scouts across the country rallying, and ultimately they got some action. You know, they got a message to senators that they needed to do things differently. That I don't mind because I don't want to shut down those who dissent, those who disagree for principled reasons. It's often happened in the past. You know, Robert M. La Follette sought to filibuster the rush into World War I as an example. But that, again, isn't what we have now. What we have now is a bureaucratic abuse that is so grotesque. It literally allows a Senate aide, not even a senator, to call in to a hotline and say, yeah, I'm filibustering. And then suddenly it can make a bill stop. It allows the minority party to prevent action, even if they only have 41, 42 senators. And that's an absurd construct because it does away with majority rule. And frankly, it does away with a functional Senate. Our Senate has not functioned in recent decades, and it's a mess. And so there's a desperate need for filibuster reform. The Senate really does need to be reformed.
John Nichols talking with me in early 2021. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.